From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Robert Reich has long been a champion of American liberalism. As Bill Clinton's Secretary of Labor from 1993 to 1997, he railed against the gap between America's rich and poor and helped pass the Family and Medical Leave Act. During his unsuccessful campaign for governor of Massachusetts in 2002, Reich was the only candidate, Republican or Democrat, to support gay marriage. Now he's banging the liberal drum again, this time in a new book called Reason, Why Liberals Will Win the Battle for America. Tonight on Point, Robert Reich, fighting liberal, takes on what he calls radical conservatism. But first, earlier today in San Francisco, Ninth Circuit U.S. District Judge Phyllis Hamilton ruled that the Partial Birth Abortion Act, signed by President Bush last year, is unconstitutional. Judge Hamilton wrote that the ban poses an undue burden on a woman's right to choose an abortion. Joining me now for perspective on today's ruling is Howard Mintz, legal affairs writer at the San Jose Mercury News. Howard, thanks for being with us.
No problem. Thank you.
Howard Mintz, who is Phyllis Hamilton? What kind of track record does she have on this? And what was the main rationale for her ruling against this ban today?
Judge Hamilton is a federal district court trial judge here in San Francisco. She is a Clinton appointee who's been on the bench actually for quite some time. She was a magistrate before that. She does have a track record in this case. When the Planned Parenthood chapters originally sued last year when the partial birth ban went into effect, she immediately put a hold on it, as did judges in two other states. So she had given more than ample signals that she was headed in this direction. The principal grounds were that she felt that this would place an undue burden on a woman's right to abortion, which was the broader finding in the case and will be of significance as this case goes forward. And she also found that the legislation failed to include enough safeguards to protect a woman's health, which was a problem in a Nebraska statute that was struck down by the U.S. Supreme Court in 2000.
Howard Mintz, what does Judge Hamilton mean by an undue burden on the right to abortion? Does it mean that a woman and or her doctor would not or could not know how late in the pregnancy that a partial birth abortion was taking place, or does it have a more judicial meaning?
Well, it's probably somewhere in between. I mean, to try to put it in the simplest terms, which is not easy in this case, the advocates of this legislation say that this procedure in question is a fairly narrow, seldom used procedure that's only implicated in a certain very late stage in pregnancy, not even second trimester. But Judge Hamilton disagreed with that and found that this was a procedure, that the legislation would implicate a very commonly used set of procedures that women use in the second term. And so that the legislation was so vague and overbroad that it cast such a wide net that it would infringe on abortion rights in other procedures that are considered okay.
Of course, this was framed as something that would affect a very small number of cases. But all around this act was the ideological fight over abortion itself, the very naming of it as partial birth abortion being a kind of way of conferring, humanness on the fetus. Did Judge Hamilton address the political surround of this issue at all in her ruling today?
No, and that's in 117 pages, so she steered pretty clear of that. There was ample discussion in there about the legislative and congressional origins of this, but it tended to focus more around the expert testimony that she heard in a trial she held earlier this spring. Certainly, there was discussion of U.S. Supreme Court precedent conferring the right to abortion in Roe v. Wade and the Casey decision, but the politics wasn't involved. In her findings, as you can imagine, since the decision came out today, though, politics has come into play. You've seen statements from the Bush campaign, the Kerry campaign, all the various groups opposed and for abortion. So the politics aren't far away from this issue.
How will this now proceed through the judiciary, Howard?
Well, you've got two other cases that are very similar challenges that are pending in New York and Nebraska, where judges also conducted trials very similar, almost identical to what Judge Hamilton conducted. Those district courts will issue decisions in those cases. All three are in separate federal appeals courts, so all three will wind up percolating up in through the system to federal appellate review. And then at that point, you know, and we're probably talking maybe a year down the line, we may see this on the U.S. Supreme Court's plate.
So stay tuned. Howard Mintz, thanks a lot for being with us tonight.
Sure, thank you.
Howard Mintz is legal affairs writer for the San Jose Mercury News. He spoke with me from San Jose, California. For the past 20 years, Robert Reich writes in his new book, liberals have been in disarray, mired in identity politics, and on the defensive. Meanwhile, what he calls radical conservatives have pursued their agenda of policing private morality, cutting taxes, and confronting evil with plenty of organization and plenty of passion. And yet, argues Reich, a majority of Americans still agree with the liberal stand when it comes to religion, abortion, taxes, and a host of other hot-button issues. It is time, says Reich, for liberals to fight back, to reclaim the language of values and morality, to unite their single-issue advocacy groups into a cohesive political movement, to assert their liberalism proudly and passionately. This hour on Point, Robert Reich and the struggle for the soul of America. Robert Reich says he's sure liberals will win. Are you so sure? Who's winning now? Is reason really on the liberal side? Do they deserve to win? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is Robert Reich, former U.S. Secretary of Labor, now professor of social and economic policy at Brandeis University, and author of Reason, Why Liberals Will Win the Battle for America. Good evening and welcome, Robert Reich.
Hello, Tom.
Good to see you. Also with us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Bob.
Hello, Jack.
All right, Robert Reich, so here's your call to battle. Liberals, put on your armor and get out there before the gates of Troy. Conservatives are not just conservatives in the new world of Robert Reich. They are radical conservatives, or in your coinage, rad cons. What is a rad con, Robert Reich?
Very different from traditional conservatives, Tom. Traditional conservatives, for example, believe in fiscal responsibility almost to a fault. Radical conservatives don't seem to care one whit how much deficit we compile. Traditional conservatives are very concerned about the use of American power abroad. In fact, many of them have been isolationists. They want to be very cautious before we commit ourselves. Radical conservatives couldn't care less. I mean, they want to really assert American military power, even without very much foreign support among our allies. And finally, and we could go on at some length, but finally, most importantly, I think, traditional conservatives are very concerned about civility. They have written and talked for years about the coarsening of American culture. Radical conservatives, if you listen to them on radio or television, the talk radio, talk television, the sparkling tribute to the First Amendment, with this show accepted, of course, a lot of radical conservatives they are uncivil in the extreme. They're screeds. They write screeds. They talk in screed language. They use character assassination very often. They are bellicose in the extreme.
But interestingly, when you talk about radcons, radical conservatives, it's not nearly as small a group as the more famous cons lately, neocons or neoconservatives. The conservatives that you describe include millions of Americans.
Well, I don't know that there's a particular survey.
There's church-going evangelicals.
Many of them are right-wing church-going evangelicals.
There are millions of such
people. And certainly there are millions of them. They are the backbone of the new Republican Party. They have allied themselves with a lot of corporate chieftains to create a movement in the Republican Party that has been much more successful in terms of claiming the presidency, not the popular vote last time, but the Electoral College, certainly Congress, most state legislatures, most governors, and many school boards throughout the country. They are on a roll. I don't think they will continue to be so, Tom. I think that liberals Or maybe some people would rather consider themselves progressives. We'll talk about why progressives are a more popular word. I think that the future is on our side.
Maybe, but you say in the interim they are on a roll, and you call the radcons, the radical conservatives, in their millions, potentially dangerous to the very stability of the United States.
Certainly with regard to their foreign policy, with regard to their attack on civil liberties, with regard to their attack on environmental protection and worker safety, their willingness, in fact, eagerness to provide big tax breaks to people who are very wealthy at a time in our nation's history when the gap between the top and the bottom and everybody between, all rungs on the economic ladder, are wider apart than they've been since arguably the 1890s. In all these respects and many others, they are, it seems to me, dangerous. They don't represent true American ideals or values. They are, in that sense, an aberration from what we have come to seek as a nation.
So there are the radical conservatives, the radcons in Robert Reich's parlance, and that would include most of the Bush administration and many of its supporters, as I read you, in the opposite corner, on the other side of what you describe conservatives, at least, radcons in your language, seeing as a civil war, no less than that, the liberals. And you say standing right beside the liberals is reason itself.
Reason, logic, principle. But let me not pass your comment about the Civil War. That was used by Newt Gingrich very early on in his trying to create in the late 70s and then ultimately quite successfully by the early 1990s when he took over Congress. He and his legions took over Congress, trying to create a conservative movement.
But he wasn't kidding. He meant battle by other means.
Yes, he did.
Battle by ballot means.
Absolutely did. And he was, and still is in many respects, the leader, one of the leaders of the radical conservative movement. Robert Bork, another person I respect a great deal. I worked for him.
Your former boss years ago.
I worked for him.
First job out of law school.
Yes, indeed. I admit that publicly. And I respect the man. I respect a lot of them. The issue is not so much do you respect them. In fact, in the book, I try to take their ideas seriously. I try to take them on in terms of what they say, what they represent, and show why they are wrong, why their logic is fundamentally flawed.
But
yes, we have reason on our side.
Yeah, and if so, why do the radcons stand a chance in the face of reason?
Because they have been so well organized. Their funding sources for 20 years have been so replenishment, giving them the institutional power that they have in Washington and in state capitals. They do dominate talk radio and talk television. They also are extraordinarily disciplined, and this may be because they are, and I don't want to, again, engage in a kind of negative name-calling of the sort that I don't, in fact, I very much dislike, but they are quite
authoritative. Radcon's a term of endearment.
Well, it's not a term of endearment. It's not a term that I use to assassinate any individual's character. In fact, again, the book and the tone of the book, and I believe very strongly that what we need to do in this country is restore civil dialogue and civil debate. I use the term radcon, Tom, because I want to describe a movement that needs to be described and understood as a political movement. Liberals, in many respects, need the courage of our convictions to stand up to this and also to represent what I think is a majoritarian view. Most Americans don't consider themselves liberal because the term itself has got such a beating from conservatives over the past 20 years. But if you actually look at mainstream polls, you see that most Americans actually on the issues are quite liberal.
Jack Beatty, reason, and liberals will win the battle. They have reason on their side, Robert Reich says.
Well, that's a good ally to have in some quarters, but this is America, and three times as many Americans believe in the virgin birth as believe in evolution. So somebody coming out with a program built around reason has got a steep climb, which isn't to say it can't be done. You have to ask why. Well, I think the reason really goes to explain the appeal of radcon. I disagree with Bob. I think it's much wider and much more populistically based in a reaction against modernity, a reaction against quote-unquote liberalism, a reaction against all the forces that seem to be solvents on all the old values.
We're going to come back and look at all of that. We're joined tonight by Robert Reich, author of the new book, Reason Why Liberals Will Win the Battle for America. You can join the conversation. What about it? Will liberals win? Are you as sure as Robert Reich
Are liberals the new silent majority? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the case for a liberal revival against radical conservatism. My guest is Robert Reich, author of the new book, Reason, Why Liberals Will Win the Battle for America. You can join this conversation. What about it? Will liberals win? Are you as sure as Robert Reich? Is reason enough for liberals to carry the day? And as we talk tonight, who's winning the battle? Rad cons or liberals? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Robert Reich, what about Jack Beatty's observation that radical conservatism looks like a populist political movement today, widely based and not necessarily susceptible to the blandishments of reason?
Well, it's not just reason, Tom. You accused me of arguing that only reason is sufficient, but that's not what I argue
in
the book.
I suggest
reason is necessary, but it's not sufficient. We also have to have passion and organization, mm-hmm. and certainly the radical conservatives do have a lot of that. But let me give you some statistics here. According to mainstream polls, now these are polls that have no axe to grind. These are polls by Wall Street Journal and Roper and so on.
Yep.
66% of Americans would be willing to pay more taxes to improve the quality of inner-city public schools. 62% say the federal government should do more to regulate the environment and safety practices of businesses. And I could go on. 61% say wrongdoing by chief executives is widespread. It's not just a few corrupt individuals. 80% say big companies have too much power and influence in Washington. Almost 60% say abortion should be left up to a woman and the doctor. More people think terrorism and the threat of terrorism has increased as a result of our military action in Iraq than decreased.
The implication of all this being
that liberal values, liberal assumptions about these issues, liberal positions on these and many, many other issues are favored by a majority. You call them the silent majority. Maybe it is a new silent majority. They are not as loud, clearly, as the radical conservatives. But this is the heartland of America, Tom. In fact, it's interesting. These polls are substantiated by a unwitting free-floating focus group I conducted across America as I drove out in January with my elder son, right across red America. You know,
yeah.
The color-coded, it's
that
odd
that
it's called red America, isn't it?
Yeah,
really,
well, it used to be Lenin, but never mind, it's Bush.
But anyway, we went into, there was no sign that said, welcome to red America. You just sort of enter into southern Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
And
there you are.
And we, you know, it's side cafes and diners. We would sit there, and I'm fairly conspicuous. People would come up and say, aren't you George Stephanopoulos? And I say, no, I'm Robert Reich. And then they'd sit down and invite themselves to sit with us.
Yeah.
And they'd say, well, we're Republicans. Mm-hmm. I said, well, that's great. I respect you. And then we'd have a discussion about issues.
Mm-hmm.
It might drag on for 10 minutes, 15 minutes, a half hour, all across. And this is Missouri and Oklahoma. And I wrote, this is after I wrote the book, and I was so interested to learn from these people that when it came down to the specific issues I've enumerated, issues about privacy, issues concerning civil liberties, the war in Iraq, economic populism, corporations, whatever have you, they sounded liberal. Now, they were Republicans, self-described Republicans, many of them self-described conservatives. They listened to Rush Limbaugh. They had all the vocabulary, all the slogans down, Tom. But when it came to what they really thought about issues, they could be from Massachusetts, Eastern Massachusetts.
I've got some relatives you ought to meet that would not sound that way over steak and eggs. But if that's the case, Robert Reich, I wonder. But if it is, then why does the GOP control both houses of Congress and the White House?
Again, so well organized, so well funded, so passionate, authoritarian, I think, and disciplined in how they've done things. The Democratic Party has not stood for very much. In fact, in the book, I take on the Democratic Party over the last 20 years. I've been a Democrat, a loyal Democrat. But they've lost their way.
You think Bill Clinton lost the way for them?
I think Bill Clinton tried to triangulate Do you remember that famous
equidistance? Find the middle ground.
Well, you know, every time you find the middle ground, if one side, in this case right-wing Republicans, stay the course, they don't move, and if you continue to compromise, every time you compromise again, you're moving further and further to the right. And I think that, unfortunately, and I was very proud to be a member of the Clinton administration, but unfortunately, by triangulating, Bill Clinton didn't help build a progressive movement, help turn the Democratic Party into a movement that could have helped support even him in terms of getting health care or many of the other things he wanted
to get. Down the line. I want to look at the specific planks of your argument here, morality, prosperity, patriotism. But before we do, Jack, I want to get your reaction to Robert Reich's informal floating focus group of steak and egg
and
eaters.
And my polls. Now, Tom, don't forget the polls.
Yes,
I gave you some
and his
very
polls
specific
from
poll
the
numbers.
Wall Street Journal, no less, and others. But, Jack, still, as you say, there is a powerful element of populism to this conservative movement, radical conservative, if you like.
Yeah, let's posit a fellow in southern Ohio. Bob comes up to him and he says, what concerns you? What are you worried about? And the fellow says, well, you know, my job. I mean, I'm really worried about my job. And Bob says, well, you know, I mean, we really need to have affirmative action in America, don't you think? So that, you know, maybe you'd be the one who'd be best qualified or with seniority at the plant. But we really have to think about minorities. And well, the fellow says, you're right about that. And then Bob says, and, you know, trade. I mean, I know people like you in manufacturing think, oh, man, trade. You're just selling us down the river for cheap labor. But, you know, it makes everybody better off when we have free trade. And sure, you may lose your job, but just think of the jobs other people will get, of the jobs your kid will get. Mm-hmm. And hey, we'll even send you to adult education so you can get a better job. Maybe not here in Southern Ohio, but someplace. It'll work out for you. Oh, and the guy says, I'm also worried about morals. Oh, and Bob says, morals. Oh, those greedy executives. Oh, those selfish Wall Street people. The guy says, no. I'm worried about, you know, my family, my daughter. And Bob says, well, you know what? I think we liberals guarantee that a daughter should be able to get an abortion without you knowing anything about it. Because after all, it's her body. It's a fundamental right. It's autonomy. It's all these liberal values. Well, the fellow starts to scratch his head and he says, so this is what liberalism is. And he begins to wonder. So, Bob, I just think that the message is not
Jack, you must have been there. You are a fly on the wall. You are putting words into my mouth, Jack Beatty. That's not the kind of conversation. By the way, how do you explain? I mean, if you have a very important point, Jack, and I don't mean to make light of it, and that is that too many Democrats, too many liberals have not addressed the real problems of working Americans. And if you don't have a college degree and you're a male worker in America, you've been on a downward escalator for the last 25 years. And that accounts for some of the anger and frustration out there on which radical conservatives have based much of their plank, much of their blame, when they blame affirmative action or blame immigrants or blame feminists or blame foreigners or blame the French. All of that blame has its origin, it seems to me, in the resentment and anger that has not been addressed adequately by Democrats and liberals.
So Democrats are still coming forward in the same clothing then? Are you bringing the same plank right back?
Well, I'm not. In fact, in this book, I attempt to address much more directly the frustrations and anxieties and worries of working Americans. It is important, I think, to have a bold liberalism, to have a liberalism that is proud of itself and confident about itself. Liberals, progressives, Democrats have got to bite the bullet. We've got to recognize that the plight of working America is really at issue here. Jobs are very central. Kitchen table economics, something I have been talking about for years. Health care. These are issues that people care deeply about.
Draw your distinctions, your battle lines, if you will, on the three main points that you go to: morality, prosperity, and patriotism.
On morality, liberals should not be afraid of the term, but instead of policing bedrooms, as radical conservatives want to do, we ought to be talking about policing boardrooms. What has happened over the last 3 or 4 years, the revelations about corporate malfeasance, nonfeasance, looting companies, firing workers, paying executives huge sums of money, this undermines the trust on which capitalism depends, and it is fundamentally a moral issue. We ought to call it for what it is. It's shameful. And secondly, it seems to me very, very important that we regard issues of morality in terms of how we treat each other, what citizenship actually means. Patriotism is a term that radical conservatives use a lot Tom. But it seems to me that liberals need to adopt patriotism and say, look, if you are going to shelter your income in the Cayman Islands or in Bermuda, you just aren't being patriotic. You are actually turning your back on America. If you are not willing to serve this country, if you are simply profiteering on this war, as there is some evidence Dick Cheney has been doing, well, you are not patriotic. That we don't call a patriot somebody who's a war profiteer. Let's again be willing to adopt patriotism and not be afraid of the term, just like we shouldn't be afraid of morality.
And prosperity, it's a big plank in every GOP announcement.
And I think liberals ought to adopt prosperity, have their own theory of prosperity, which is not about giving tax breaks to the rich. It's not trickle-down economics. That doesn't work. We've seen supply-side economics to be the fraud. It was already in the 1980s. But let's be very clear that the key to prosperity is to invest in our workers, in their education, in their health, to make all Americans more productive and give everybody a chance to rise in this great country.
So patriotism, not the redcons, as you write, bullying negative version of patriotism, prosperity, not the trickle-down version, and morality, not the private morality that conservatives look to, but public morality to do with the boardroom. As Robert Reich says, not the bedroom. A lot of callers want to join us. Let's turn to them. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Howard is calling from Randolph, Massachusetts. Hi, Howard. You're on the air.
Hi. Everything that Professor Reich says strikes me as dead on, except for his notion that people will allow liberal ideas to triumph to trump conservative ideas. It just seems to me that most of the time in most people, emotion trumps reason. And you can see this in the way that even folks who are otherwise very bright can believe all sorts of nonsense. I mean, you can see it, for example, in the way that people swallowed those silly arguments against gay marriage. As well, when I listen to Radcon's talk, it seems to me that what I'm hearing mostly, as I think your other guest mentioned,
Jack Beatty,
is fear and anger. And I wish Professor Reich would say a few words about how he expects logic and reason to get through to such folks who, incidentally, usually think that they're the very paragons of reason, logic, and analysis.
It's a good question, Howard. Thanks for bringing it to us. Robert Reich, here it is again. I'm not sure everybody would agree with Howard that arguments over gay marriage are silly. I know many people don't think so, but then Howard's saying, well, it's fear and anger. And how do you break through that with ideas if that's what you're resting your case on?
Look, undoubtedly, there is a great deal of fear and anger out there. And we've talked about some of the reason is just economic anxiety. It continues even as the economy improves. But my point is that the radical conservatives have used fear and anger in a way that divides Americans from one another and also divides America from the rest of the world. They see the world in terms of good and evil, black and white. You're either with us or you're against us. You're either lazy or a sexual deviant, or you are part of the mainstream. And if you are on the wrong side of the great divide, you are unworthy. You are somebody who should not be allowed to be part of our society. Or, in the case of evildoers abroad, you should be exterminated. Now, superficially, that can be very attractive to people who are, again, fearful and troubled with, as Jack said, modernity itself. But if you get under the slogans...
Not to say immorality,
yes,
which
absolutely,
does exist.
Immorality in terms of... But again, we deeply believe, and this goes back to not only the polls and my free-floating focus group, but all we know from all of the polling that's been done over the recent years, most Americans do believe, for example, that church and state ought to be separated. Most Americans deeply believe that concentrated economic power in corporations or wherever is very dangerous to our democracy. Most Americans believe in social insurance, Social Security, Medicare, and so forth. And most Americans understand the importance of international law.
But you raised polls. I've got a poll here that says that most Americans, including Republicans and Democrats, agree that moral values in the United States are less good and getting worse. This is from last week, May 21st. If that's the case, and I'm not sure they're making the fine distinction you do, not so fine, but nevertheless, between private and public morals, how do you speak to all those people who do believe that morals are declining and that this is in some way tied to greater social problems they see in the country. Do you have a message for them other than what Jack is suggesting? Oh, come on, get with the program, separate church and state, stop fretting about
stuff. I think the message, and I agree with Howard, the last caller, that we have to, liberals can't simply rely on reason or logic. Values in terms of morality, patriotism, prosperity, values are very important. But I think the message to people who think that America is off track is to say, yes, America is off track. I mean, what we're doing in Iraq is immoral. What's happening in boardrooms is immoral. But in terms of what happens in your bedroom or in other people's bedrooms, that is maybe immoral, but that's not the business of government. We don't want a state in which government is actually intruding upon the private relationships between individuals. Morality, and I think a distinction has got to be drawn between public and private morality, morality becomes public when it undermines our capacity to function together, when it actually injures a lot of people, such as the corporate immorality we've been seeing, such as what many people would say is our immoral foreign policy.
Brian's calling from Erie, Pennsylvania. Hi, Brian. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Wow. Great. Thanks.
Now, Robert, whenever I hear you speaking, you always speak with a great deal of sense, and it always makes a lot of sense to me. But none of the ideas that you expound so far strike me as particularly liberal. We in the what I like to call the radical middle have been talking about these things for years, and neither the Republicans nor the Democrats seem to ever do anything about them.
Brian, which ideas specifically?
Well, for instance, fiscal responsibility, which you talk about a lot, but I never hear liberals talk about. They just want to spend a lot.
Let's stop at that just for one moment and go on with your list. Look, I say in the book, and I've been saying for years, that it's not the size of government that's at issue. It's who is government standing up for. In other words, I don't think liberals want, I certainly don't want, most of the people who consider themselves liberal don't want a big government that is working for the rich or for the powerful or intruding on your privacy or on your library cards. Don't want a big government that is spending lavishly on corporate welfare. The issue, again, is who is government working for? Who is it protecting? Who is it representing?
Well, I also think that certain ideas of liberalism that most of us see are things like free abortions and very open borders and welfare for whoever wants it and very anti-Christian ideas and gay marriage and all these things are very... They're a lot farther left than I think most of the people that you've been talking to in the middle of the country.
Brian, we've just got a minute and a half left, so let me let you go there. But thanks for your call, Robert Reich. You got 1 minute.
Yes,
there's the pitch.
A mainstream poll show 59% of Americans say abortion should be left up to the woman and her doctor.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Now, Brian, you are right with regard to gay marriage. If you are over 30, you do approve civil unions, but you probably are very bothered by gay marriage. But under 30. And again, those under 30-year-olds are getting older, and in a few years, they may be a majority. If you're under 30, you do approve gay marriage, and you look upon it as a civil right and a human right.
So there we are. Brian, thanks for your call. We've got to take a short break here. We're talking tonight about the case for a liberal revival and against radical conservatism. My guest is Robert Reich, former Secretary of Labor and author of the new book, Reason Why Liberals Will Win the Battle for America. You can join the conversation. Can the passion of conservative concern with private morality, with sex and family, be transferred to issues of public morality, CEO compensation, environmental destruction, or are these apples and oranges? Is reason on the side of liberals? Do you buy that basic contention? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. My guest tonight, Robert Reich, former Secretary of Labor, author of the new book, Reason Why Liberals Will Win the Battle for America. You can join our conversation tonight. Are liberals the new silent majority, as Robert Reich suggests? And as we talk tonight, who is in fact winning the battle? Radcons, radical conservatives, as he labels them, or liberals? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jack Beatty's with us as well. And right now, Rick calling from Boston. Hi, Rick. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
You know, Mr. Reich, I've been listening to you speak this evening, and I confess I'm not sure who you think that your book is speaking to. I'm a physician, live in the suburbs, serve a very diverse community. I actually even sat behind you once at High Holiday Services at the Harvard Hillel. I'm no whatever, just to identify myself for your audience. I don't see that people are walking around or coming into my office and complaining and worried about corporate corruption as their big problem, their big concern with government. I just don't see that any of the issues that you're bringing up are really the deep issues that people are concerned about.
And what are the issues that you think are the deep issues, Rick?
Well, I can tell you in my own life and in my practice, I see people are concerned about their children, about the nature of our society, about how they're raising their children, about how they're having to raise their grandchildren, and very frequently how they think that the government is permissive in many of these areas.
So you think it is private morality that people are more concerned with?
I think there are elements of that. I certainly agree that Americans don't want the government completely in their bedroom. They are in favor of abortion, yet they would favor some restrictions. So that there's a kind of a middle ground. But they're surely just not, the average working person is not walking around with a burning desire to get the corporate raiders.
Rick, stand by. Let's put it to Robert Reich. Stick with this. Robert Reich.
Rick, I guess I would recommend that you read my book before you take me on in terms of exactly who my book is directed to. The main point that I make in the book is that radical conservatives, people who profess to represent America, have taken over much of the public dialogue, public discourse, and many of the major power centers of America, accusing liberals of being liberal elites who are really in control when liberals are not in control at all, and imposing a very crimped version, a corporate commonwealth that is, in some ways, they're trying to legitimize by a war in Iraq, a military presence that is infusing a lot of America with all sorts of things that we might find, and certainly I find objectionable, such an attack on civil liberties, a federal budget that is becoming increasingly not only militarized, but also favoring to the rich, to the exclusion of a lot of social policies. Education is being cut. Low-income housing is being cut. Now, one option, Rick, is to stand back and say, well, this is just the way America's going. It's just drifting to the right. And, the people that come into my clinic, I'm a physician, the people that come to the clinic, they don't complain about this, and I'm not going to worry about it. The other possibility, though, is to say, this is wrong. This is a challenge to our values. If we don't get politically active, if we don't see not just the upcoming election, but also the next years as a defining moment for America, we and our children and grandchildren are going to suffer the consequences. This book is a call to arms, but not in terms of a battle cry, violent battle cry, obviously. This is a call to arms in terms of ideas and argumentation. We want, and I want, a tough liberalism, a liberalism that is going to have the courage of its convictions.
Rick, what do you say? Maybe your patients should be thinking about these issues or not.
One final example,
yeah.
And I think it sort of shows, how, Mr. Reich, how you're just off base. You know, I speak to many people in my office, and I have a nuanced view myself about the war in Iraq. And I speak to a lot of people about it. Very few of them think that President Bush went to war for some malign, evil purpose, even those who don't agree. They don't think he went to war for Halliburton or for oil companies or because he felt bad about his daddy. They don't. Many of them don't agree. But none of them think him a bad person for it. That he did it for some bad reason. They may think he's wrong.
Rick, we've got it. Let me put it to Robert Reich, thanks for your call.
That's exactly the point. I don't think he's a bad person, and the whole point of my book is to get us out of the kind of ad hominem attacks on one another, whether it's Robert Bork or Bill Bennett or the president, and get us looking at the issues themselves, the issues, the values, the principles by which we want to be governed, the direction we want to take the country. Now, why did George W. Bush lead us into Iraq? I don't know, but it seems to me it was a terrible mistake. American values are in the eyes of the rest of the world, becoming a kind of contorted reflection of what they ought to be. Our moral authority has declined dramatically. At a time when we desperately need allies, we are looking like bullies. And therefore, when most Americans in, again, the polls that I refer to, say that as a result of the Iraqi war, the likelihood of terrorism is greater than it was before, it seems to me that that reflects a deep-seated concern by Americans, whether they are coming into your office or not, I don't know, that we are heading in the wrong direction, that we have to have fundamental change.
Rick, thanks for your call. Robert Reich, but what about the sort of seed here in Rick's comment that is there something fundamentally dismissive about your argument here that the conservatives that you describe, you describe as resting all of their positions on ideology and on a sense of evil or private moral concerns that you kind of describe as absurd? Can you reach out from that position, or are you writing them off? Is this a book that's intended to say, come on over, or is it to rally the folks who are already on your secular, the public morality side of the ledger?
It's just the opposite of being dismissive, Tom. I want to take their ideas respectfully for the way they represent them. The book doesn't attack individuals. It doesn't distort their arguments. Whether the arguments are about private morality or economic prosperity.
Redcon's policies, by contrast, are based on ideology, not reason.
Well, that's certainly the fundamental assumption and the conclusion that I come to, because after analyzing their arguments very carefully, after looking at what they say and quoting them, it seems to me that there's very little basis for much of their argumentation. Now, I go on these shows. You know, I go on Bill O'Reilly and
yep.
Sean Hannity, and they yell at me, and I sometimes raise my voice back, and they yell back, and I sometimes yell back, and often I leave the shows not knowing exactly what I said or what they said. And I've decided that although I am going to continue to go on the shows because it's one of the few opportunities one has to engage in any kind of public debate, unfortunately, mm-hmm. in America, mm-hmm. this book is born out of a frustration that is what public dialogue, apart from your show, Tom, that's what so much public dialogue has come down to. It is dismissive in the extreme. People are not taking seriously one another's arguments. They're not dissecting them. They're not listening. And they're not paying attention to values.
Robert Reich, author of the new book, Reason Why Liberals Will Win the Battle for America. Thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Tom.
Jack Beatty, do we have a winning formula here? When do we turn the corner?
Next year in Jerusalem, or is it Washington?
We'll see. Jack, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, D-Day veterans look back at the process of preparing for invasion. This is On Point. On June 6, 1944, 176,000 Allied soldiers stormed the beaches of Normandy. D-Day was the pivotal moment in World War II. Everything was at stake. Operation Overlord invasion forces that landed on the beaches of Nazi-occupied France were backed by millions of support personnel, 6 battleships, 22 cruisers, and 63 destroyers blasted the coastline from the waters of the English Channel. 2,219 warplanes launched an assault from the skies, making D-Day the largest, most important military operation of the 20th century. Allied forces suffered nearly 10,000 casualties on the first brutal day of fighting. This Sunday marks the 60th anniversary of D-Day. In the coming days, On Point will bring you a special 4-part series of stories from the men who battled on the beaches of Normandy. We'll hear their descriptions of the preparation for invasion, the air attack, the sea attack, and the bloody, brutal fighting on Utah, Omaha, Gold, Juneau, and Sword beaches. These oral histories are part of Voices of Valor, a new book and CD collection by Douglas Brinkley and Ronald J. Drez. Tonight, Part 1, Preparing for Invasion.
In 1942, Pearl Harbor had been bombed. I was young, in good shape,
and they were not going to have a war without me.
Proceeding across the ocean in convoy, all the questions that used to come through my mind, thoughts like, were we really headed for war? Could I live up to the job as captain? How would the men react under fire? How would I react?
The townspeople were very friendly and receptive to the Americans, especially the girls. Some of those cute little accents would drive you nuts. Some made friendships that would last a lifetime. Others would find the girl of their dreams and marry.
Once in a while, they took us on marches to relieve the drabness and to keep up morale and to show us that the world outside went on without us with no trouble at all.
We soon learned to love the English as well as the English cooking. And although sometimes we missed good old American food, but we were especially fond of fish and chips.
We were often issued a sack lunch. It was actually in a brown paper bag. One sandwich had a glob of jelly in the middle. The other had a thick slice of pork luncheon meat. We called them spam and jam lunches.
This time we did extensive training virtually every day and every night. And in fact, we did spot landings, as we called. I did 43 flights altogether, which we did during the day, and then we did that 13 times at night with no lights at all.
The whole regiment at that time was doing some tough field training. Everything was urgent and serious, and we were on dawn to dusk duty 7 days a week. After all, the German Luftwaffe had been bombing England for some time. There was always the chance of a German bombing and even a German invasion.
Then on June the 5th, word came down. This was it. Today was the day.
There were crews painting the black and white invasion stripes on every one of our aircraft. We, as enlisted men, weren't told anything, but we just sat there on what seemed like a live bomb with the fuse sizzling, knowing fully well that something was going to happen within hours.
We blacked our faces with burnt cork. Some of the guys cut their hair Mohawk style. Each trooper was going into combat in whatever style that suited him best. I left mine in a crew cut. They said we'd be back in a month, so I wanted to come back looking like myself.
I wondered if we could feel all that tension, what it must have been like for a paratrooper or a first wave assault troop that knew he was going to be in one of those landing crafts or whatever, or be dropped by parachute behind enemy lines.
We lay in the grass waiting for them to tell us it's time to saddle up. We talked about home, wife and kids, sweethearts, the good times we'd had in school. We wondered how they'd take the news when they got the word that we'd jumped. I imagine it would make quite a headlines in the paper.
By early evening, every one of us was wound up like a $2 watch. And then it started. We heard aircraft overhead, by the dozens. There were so many of them, it just boggled your mind. Paratroops and gliders, the invasion of France was starting.
Harry Bear, Anthony Duke, Peter Masters, Dwayne Burns, Robert Walker, Oliver Bolin, and Roger Lovelace, just a few of the 175,000 American and British troops who stormed the beaches of Normandy 60 years ago this Sunday. Tomorrow night, part two of our special D-Day series, The Air Invasion. Special thanks for the audio of these oral histories to Douglas Brinkley and Ronald J. Drez of the Eisenhower Center for American Studies at the University of New Orleans. Their new book and CD set is called Voices of Valor. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.